Section 4, The End of the Cold War. An American Story. On October 31, 1990, General Colin Powell, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, and other high-ranking officials, met with President George Bush. The previous August, the country of Iraq had invaded neighboring Kuwait. American troops had been rushed to the Middle East in response. Now the president had to decide whether to go to war. General Brent Scowcroft, a close advisor to Bush, began the meeting. "Mr. President, we are at a Y in the road. Down one branch, we can continue sanctions. Down the other branch, we go on the attack." Powell then presented the plan for attacking Iraq. Several advisors gasped at the numbers, which called for over 500,000 American troops. "Mr. President," Powell began, "I wish that I could assure you that air power alone could do it. But you can't take that chance. We've got to take the initiative out of the enemy's hands if we're going to go to war." Cheney later recalled that Bush never hesitated. He looked up from the plans and said simply, "Do it." Adapted from Triumph Without Victory and PBS Frontline Gulf War Interviews. George Bush takes office. The war in the Persian Gulf was only one of many international crises that confronted President George Bush after his election in 1988. Fortunately, Bush's strength was in foreign policy. In the 1970s, he had served as ambassador to the UN and as the nation's first diplomatic envoy to the People's Republic of China. He then headed the CIA from 1976 to 1977 before becoming vice president in 1981. When Ronald Reagan left office, few Americans were thinking about foreign policy. They generally wanted a continuation of Reagan's domestic policies, low taxes and less government action. When Bush accepted the Republican nomination in 1988, he tried to reassure Americans by making a promise: "Read my lips, no new taxes." The Democrats hoped to regain the White House in 1988 by promising to help working-class Americans, minorities, and the poor. One candidate for the nomination, civil rights leader Jesse Jackson, tried to create a rainbow coalition, a broad group of minorities and the poor, by speaking about homelessness and unemployment. Jackson finished second in the primaries, the first African American to make a serious run for the nomination. The Democrats' final choice was Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. The Bush campaign portrayed him as too liberal, unpatriotic, and soft on crime. The Democrats questioned Bush's leadership abilities, but Bush had Reagan's endorsement, and with the economy still doing well, few Americans wanted to switch parties. Bush won 54% of the popular vote and defeated Dukakis 426 to 111 in the Electoral College. Democrats, however, kept control of Congress. Reading check. Describing: what kind of strategy did the Bush campaign use in the 1988 election? The Cold War ends. Almost immediately after taking office, President Bush had to draw on his foreign policy experience. With the help of Secretary of State James Baker, the president steered the United States through an era of sweeping change that resulted from the sudden end of the Cold War. Gorbachev's reforms. As president, Bush continued Reagan's policy of cooperation with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. By the late 1980s, the Soviet economy was suffering from years of inefficient central planning and huge expenditures on the arms race. To save the economy, Gorbachev instituted perestroika, or restructuring, and allowed some private enterprise and profit-making. The other principle of Gorbachev's plan was glasnost, or openness. It allowed more freedom of religion and speech, allowing people to discuss politics openly. Revolution in Eastern Europe. With Gorbachev's support, glasnost spread to Eastern Europe. In 1989, peaceful revolutions replaced communist rulers with democratic governments in Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria. The spreading revolution soon reached East Germany, and at midnight on November 9, 1989, guards at the Berlin Wall opened the gates. Within days, bulldozers leveled the hated symbol of communist repression. Within a year, East and West Germany had reunited. The Soviet Union collapses. As Eastern Europe abandoned communism, Gorbachev faced mounting criticism from opponents at home. In August 1991, a group of communist officials and army officers staged a coup, an overthrow of the government. They arrested Gorbachev and sent troops into Moscow. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin defied the coup leaders from his offices in the Russian parliament. About 50,000 people surrounded the Russian parliament to protect it from troops. President Bush telephoned Yeltsin to express the support of the United States. Soon afterward, the coup collapsed and Gorbachev returned to Moscow. The defeat of the coup brought change swiftly. All 15 Soviet republics declared their independence from the Soviet Union. Yeltsin outlawed the Communist Party in Russia. In late December 1991, Gorbachev announced the end of the Soviet Union. Most of the former Soviet republics then joined in a federation called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Reading check. Explaining. Why did Mikhail Gorbachev institute the policy of perestroika? The New World Order. After the Cold War, the world became increasingly unpredictable in a phrase made popular by President Bush. A new world order was developing. While trying to redefine American foreign policy, Bush faced crises in China, Panama, and the Middle East. Tragedy in Tiananmen Square. Despite the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, China's communist leaders were determined to stay in power. China's government had relaxed controls on the economy, but it continued to repress political speech and dissent. In May 1989, Chinese students and workers held demonstrations for democracy. In early June, government tanks and soldiers crushed their protests in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, China's capital. Many people were killed, and hundreds of pro-democracy activists were arrested. Many were later sentenced to death. These events shocked the world. The United States and several European countries halted arms sales and reduced their diplomatic contacts with China. The World Bank suspended loans. Some congressional leaders urged even stronger sanctions, but President Bush resisted these harsher measures, believing that trade and diplomacy would eventually moderate China's behavior. Panama. While President Bush struggled to deal with global events elsewhere, a crisis developed in Panama. In 1978, the United States had agreed to give Panama control over the Panama Canal in the year 2000. Because of the canal's importance, American officials wanted to make sure Panama's government was both stable and pro-American. By 1989, Panama's dictator, General Manuel Noriega, had stopped cooperating with the United States. He also aided drug traffickers, cracked down on opponents, and harassed American military personnel defending the canal. In December 1989, Bush ordered American troops to invade Panama. The troops seized Noriega, who was sent to the United States to stand trial on drug charges. The troops then helped the Panamanians hold elections and organize a new government. The Persian Gulf War. President Bush faced perhaps his most serious crisis in the Middle East. In August 1990, Iraq's dictator Saddam Hussein sent his army to invade oil-rich Kuwait. American officials feared the invasion was only the first step and that Iraq's ultimate goal was to capture Saudi Arabia and its vast oil reserves. President Bush persuaded other UN member countries to join a coalition to stop Iraq. Led by the United States, the United Nations first imposed economic sanctions on Iraq and demanded the Iraqis withdraw. The coalition forces included troops from the United States, Canada, Europe, and Arab nations. The UN set a deadline for the Iraqi withdrawal, or the coalition would use force to remove them. Congress also voted to authorize the use of force if Iraq did not withdraw. Iraq refused to comply with the UN deadline, and on January 16, 1991, the coalition forces launched Operation Desert Storm. Dozens of cruise missiles and thousands of laser-guided bombs fell on Iraq, destroying its air defenses, bridges, artillery, and other military targets. After about 6 weeks of bombardment, the coalition launched a massive ground attack. Waves of tanks and troop carriers smashed through Iraqi lines and encircled the Iraqi forces defending Kuwait. The attack killed thousands of Iraqi soldiers. Hundreds of thousands more surrendered. Less than 300 coalition troops were killed. Just 100 hours after the ground war began, President Bush declared victory. "Kuwait is liberated," he announced. Iraq accepted the coalition's ceasefire terms. American troops returned home to cheering crowds celebrating the U.S. victory in the first large-scale war since Vietnam. Reading check. Examining. Why did President Bush take action when Iraqi troops invaded Kuwait? Domestic challenges. President Bush spent much of his time dealing with foreign policy, but he could not ignore domestic issues. He inherited a growing deficit and a slowing economy. As the Persian Gulf crisis began, the economy plunged into a recession and unemployment rose rapidly. Economics. The economy slows. The recession that began in 1990 was partly caused by the end of the Cold War. As the Soviet threat faded, the United States began reducing its armed forces and canceling orders for military equipment. Thousands of soldiers and defense industry workers were laid off. Across the nation, other companies also began downsizing, laying off workers and managers to become more efficient. The nation's high level of debt made the recession worse. Americans had borrowed heavily during the 1980s and now faced paying off large debts. In addition, the huge federal deficit forced the government to borrow money to pay for its programs. This borrowing kept money from being available to expanding businesses. The government also had to pay interest on its debt, money that might otherwise have been used to fund programs or jumpstart the economy. Gridlock in government. Shortly after taking office, Bush tried to improve the economy. He called for a cut in the capital gains tax, the tax paid by businesses and investors when they sell stocks or real estate for a profit. Bush believed the tax cut would encourage businesses to expand. Calling the idea a tax break for the rich, Democrats in Congress defeated it. Aware that the growing federal deficit was hurting the economy, Bush broke his No New Taxes campaign pledge. After meeting with congressional leaders, he agreed to a tax increase in exchange for cuts in spending. This decision turned many voters against Bush. They blamed him for both the tax increase and for trying to cut social programs. Extending rights. Although President Bush and Democrats in Congress disagreed on economic issues, they cooperated on other legislation. One example was the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, signed by Bush in 1990. The legislation forbade discrimination in workplaces and public places against people who were physically or mentally challenged. The law had widespread effect. Access ramps were added to buildings, closed-caption television became more commonplace, and wheelchair lifts were installed on city buses. Reading check. Summarizing. Why did President Bush lose popularity as the 1992 election approached? The 1992 election. Although the recession had weakened his popularity, Bush won the Republican nomination. Bush promised to address voters' economic concerns, and he blamed congressional Democrats for the gridlock that seemingly paralyzed the nation's government. The Democrats nominated Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, despite stories that questioned his character and his failure to serve in Vietnam. Calling himself a new Democrat to separate himself from more liberal Democrats, Clinton promised to cut middle-class taxes and spending and to reform the nation's health care and welfare programs. His campaign repeatedly blamed Bush for the recession. Many Americans were not happy with either Bush or Clinton. This enabled an independent candidate, billionaire Texas businessman H. Ross Perot, to make a strong challenge. Perot stressed the need to end deficit spending. His no-nonsense style appealed to many Americans. A grassroots movement, groups of people organizing at the local level, put Perot on the ballot in all 50 states. Bill Clinton won the election with 43% of the popular vote and 370 electoral votes. The Democrats also retained control of Congress. Bush won 38% of the popular vote, while Perot received 19%, the best showing for a third-party candidate since 1912. but no electoral votes. As the first president born after World War II, the 46-year-old Clinton was the first person from the baby boom generation to enter the White House. It was his task to revive the economy and guide the United States in a rapidly changing and increasingly technological world. Reading check. Evaluating. Why did some people vote for H. Ross Perot in 1992? How successful was his election campaign as a third-party candidate? American literature. Richard Rodriguez. Hispanic Americans are the fastest growing minority in the United States. Hispanics cherish their heritage, and many speak only Spanish among their friends and family. Most of their children's teachers, however, speak only English. As a result, Hispanic students often find school confusing and humiliating. Hispanic American Richard Rodriguez describes his struggle to become educated in his autobiography, Hunger of Memory. In this excerpt, Rodriguez describes the difficulties he encountered at home after he became comfortable speaking English at school. From Hunger of Memory by Richard Rodriguez. I grew up a victim to a disabling confusion. As I grew fluent in English, I no longer could speak Spanish with confidence. I continued to understand spoken Spanish, and in high school I learned how to read and write Spanish, but for many years I could not pronounce it. A powerful guilt blocked my spoken words. An essential glue was missing whenever I tried to connect words to form sentences. When relatives and Spanish-speaking friends of my parents came to the house, my brothers and sisters seemed reticent to use Spanish, but at least they managed to say a few necessary words before being excused. I was cursed with guilt. Each time I'd hear myself addressed in Spanish, I would be unable to respond with any success. I'd know the words I wanted to say, but I couldn't manage to say them. I would try to speak, but everything I said seemed to me horribly anglicized. My mouth would not form the words right. It surprised my listeners to hear me. They'd lower their heads, better to grasp what I was trying to say. They would repeat their questions in gentle, affectionate voices. But by then, I would answer in English. No, no, they would say, we want you to speak to us in Spanish. But I couldn't do it. Poco, then they called me. Sometimes playfully, teasing, using the tender diminutive, mi poquito. Sometimes not so playfully, mockingly, poco. A Spanish dictionary defines that word as an adjective meaning colorless or bland. But I heard it as a noun, naming the Mexican-American who, in becoming an American, forgets his native society. Analyzing literature. 1. Recall and interpret. What do you think Richard meant when he said that an essential glue was missing whenever he tried to speak Spanish? 2. Evaluate and connect. Why did Richard's relatives nickname him Poco? Interdisciplinary activity. Journalism. Interview a bilingual friend, relative, or classmate about when and where they use each of the languages they speak. Write a transcript of the interview.